This programme was first broadcast in 2008. We listen again, remembering fondly the late Jean Ritchie. We're so glad she joined us to share her songs and stories, leaving a lasting impression on everyone who heard her. Hello, Fiona Ritchie with you for The Thistle and Shamrock, along with Jean Ritchie.
Oh, when I was a curly-headed baby, my daddy sat me down upon his knee. Said, son, you go to school, learn your letters. Don't you be no dusty manner like me. Thank you.
She calls it her train song. The LNN Don't Stop Here Anymore was written by Gene Ritchie around 1958. It's been recorded by Johnny Cash, Kathy Mattea, Michelle Schacht, and of course by Jean herself. The Swannanoa Gathering is a series of summer workshops near Asheville in North Carolina's Blue Ridge Mountains. Its traditional song week provided a perfect setting for a Ritchie reunion. Jean and I first met many years ago and decided that we must be kin from an extended clan spanning the ocean and connected by a love of the traditional songs of Appalachia, Scotland and Ireland, themselves part of our musical family. So this week on Thistle, you're invited to take your seat in an intimate audience at Swannanoa to meet this remarkable woman born in 1922 and raised in Viper, Kentucky, in the heart of the Southern Appalachian Mountains. You'll hear about Jean's involvement in the New York City folk scene of the 1950s, and there'll be plenty of singing too, as we learn about her life and inspirations for her own insightful songwriting. This one also deals with her experiences in Eastern Kentucky coal country. When they started strip mining, she made her feelings known in song. Black Waters.
She sings a sweet time. In the roots of the tall timber, she nests with her young. But the hillside explodes with a dynamite's roar. And the voices of the small birds will sound there no more. And the hillsides come sweating so awful and grand. And the flame black waters rise over my land. Sad scenes of destruction on every hand. Black waters run down through the land. Destruction on every hand. Black waters run down through the land. Well, I ain't got no money in the flesh of a home.
how many Richies do we have in the room today? There are two right up here. I'm Fiona Richie, and it's my great pleasure and privilege to be sitting up here with Jean Richie. I know many of you know Jean. Many of you have met Jean before all around the country, and perhaps before here at the Swannanoa Gathering. When I was last here at the Swannanoa Gathering, I think about 8 years ago, it didn't coincide with Jean being here, so it's lovely that now it does. But I won't make a big gushy introduction of Jean, because it's all going to come out in the course of our chat, other than to say welcome to everybody, and particularly, let's welcome Jean Richie. And thank you for joining us here at the Swannanoa Gathering at Warren Wilson College in Swannanoa, North Carolina. It's just lovely to have you all here, and I'm sure by the end of our time together, we'll have turned this room into a kind of a cosy living room or front porch or back porch. I suppose one of the remarkable things about your early life that becomes more remarkable to all of us in modern times is that you are the youngest of 14 children. Which wasn't so unusual back in your day, but certainly is now.
Not only was I number 14, but I was 13 of us lived to grow up and marry and so on. That was a very, very high number of members of the family to live in those days, because I was born in 1922. My mother not only was a sensible woman, she only went through the fourth grade, but she was very sensible. But she knew all about herbs, or as the old folks said, yarbs. She knew all about yarbs and what was good for whooping cough and what was good for measles and all that kind of thing. She could go out into the woods and make medicine because there were very few doctors. My brother Wilmer and I, he's the only one still living besides me. But the two of us were the only ones that were born at home with a doctor in attendance. All the others were with the neighbor women, midwives. I come from that kind of family. It's been a wonderful life. I've really enjoyed going to many different places in the world and coming back and going to Viper, Kentucky, and looking at my mountains and my beautiful cabin that my husband built for me, and saying, this is the best place on earth.
And you fell in love with ballads early, not just the songs that were being sung in and around the family and work and play, but big ballads.
Ballads are stories, you know, so that, I guess most any song is a story if you stretch your imagination a little, but the ballads are especially have the good guy and the bad guy and or lady, and they have triangles and all kinds of things happen. People get killed, people get away. It's all something that is telling a story. So in the wintertime, we told our stories aloud, all the jack tails and things like that, and tigs and tags and long leather bags and all my gold and silver. That was a good one. And then in the summertime, we didn't want to sit around telling stories. We got out on the porch and sang them, and sang all the old ballads and lovely ones.
In a family like your family, and in those times, music accompanied daily living. It wasn't always something that was set aside special, although sometimes clearly it was. It was just something that you'd be singing as you were working in the field, you'd be singing as you were working at home, sharing songs to cheer you, sharing songs to pass a cold winter's evening. It was your entertainment.
Right, right. It's all we had to do.
I know that you've traced your family back to six Richie brothers who came across on a boat in 1768, and that was the beginning of your family in North America. But do you think some of the songs then that you sing would have come from those brothers and from those times? And also, along the way, how did other songs come into the repertoire of the Richie family?
Well, I got thinking about that, and I tried to write down some notes about where I had learned songs very early. And one of the earliest one I can remember is my mother's sweeping song. She would be sweeping the floor in the front room. It had rough boards for the floor, little narrow ones like this. They looked very well, but they were all pretty rough. So when she swept, it made a good scratchy noise and accompanied the song. And she'd be singing this song. And it mentions Old George's Square, which I think is in Scotland, maybe in Glasgow.
George Square, is that
yeah. So this is what she'd be singing. And I always thought, I didn't think of it as Old George's Square. I thought of it as Mama's Sweeping Song. So, my parents reared me tenderly. They had no child but me. But my mind was set on rambling around, and with them I couldn't agree. There was a girl in this old town, she was so wondrous fair. There was no other girl in the country round that with her I could compare. She asked me if I would agree for me to cross over the main. She said she would prove true to me till I returned again. I got my things, went to the dock. Her tears shone down like wine. We kissed, shook hands, and parted. I left my girl behind. As I walked out one morning to view Old George's Square, the mail post boat had just arrived, and the post boy met me there. He handed me a letter which gave me to understand that the girl I left behind me had married another man. Walked a few steps further on. I knew not what to do. I read the letter o'er again, and I found the news were true. I'll follow the old train, bad company I'll resign. I'll ramble around from town to town for the girl I left behind. Well, you could hear the broom sweeping in that song, couldn't you?
That floor was perfectly clean by the end of that. You know, when we hear songs like that sung by yourself, they seem so precious to us now, and we value them so much. And people, of course, that are gathered here are here because they value and revere these traditions. Did you know what you had back then? Did you value it at the time, or was it just part of living and breathing?
Well, we've got work done at the end of the day. We sat out on the porch and sang our favorite songs, sort of went around the circle and chose what we wanted to sing, and we enjoyed the songs, we enjoyed the stories, but we never thought of them in an intellectual sort of way. We never thought that we were learning something precious. We never thought that they were worth anything except to us. So, no, we didn't. We didn't have a teaching approach to them at all. It's just if you heard a song and liked it, you learned it, that's all.
My children at school in Scotland now are taught poems in Scots. They're taught songs in Gaelic. They're encouraged to celebrate these aspects of our culture. Not that very long ago, when I was at school, we were discouraged from speaking in Scots dialect in the classroom. It would be corrected by our teachers. and frowned upon. It was okay in the playground. And even maybe by your mum when you came indoors, don't speak like that in the house, you know. It would be what you spoke like out in the street. But that's not the way of it now. But it was interesting to read in your book again, Singing Family Cumberlands, which is a great insight into your life, your early life, that the settlement school, when it came to your part of Kentucky, they did appear to value the songs, and that they would almost informally collect the songs from children, share the songs, and teach the songs among the children. Was that because these particular ladies were special ladies, or was that pretty common at the time, and were the schools an important way of sort of sharing the tradition?
Well, it got to be, we got to realize some of the value of the songs through this way, because the ladies, as they were called from, or the choir women, from far off, they came from New England in the beginning, and then from Lexington, and from the churches would send women down to teach. Mostly, very seldom would a man come. It was mostly women. And we began to realize that the songs meant something extra special to them, and so we began to learn about it then. And that we began to recognize the ones that maybe came from Scotland and the ones that maybe came from Ireland and England. And those three countries were the three backgrounds for our part of Appalachia. So we sort of learned that about the songs. My father came from Knott County, and he came all the way over to Perry County to court my mother. And to the day he died, he lived to be 89 years old. He married my mother when he was 26 or so. He was always called that man from Knott County.
Speaking
he was a foreigner.
Speaking of that man from Knott County, Bayless Ritchie, yeah. Your father, he was a fiddler, wasn't he? So, and he played tunes for sets. And
He taught himself, yeah. He saw a man play fiddle once that had come in from Virginia. And down in his school when he was a little boy, and he said everybody got up. He said he started it because he couldn't sit still. He was playing Shady Grove, and Dad got up and started dancing on his desk, and all the others did so too. And the teacher was so happy to hear the music and everything that he didn't even fuss at them. He let them dance on their desks.
I think Shady Grove is a song that's become quite associated with you, Jean. Would you maybe share a wee verse of it with us?
I could, but I can't play the dulcimer. I left my picks at home. Anybody got a pick? Sort of a flexible. I sent Johnny out to look under trees, and he found this nice little stick for me. Yeah, maybe that. That might do it. Let's see. Remember whose pick this is. Oh, you've got one too.
Oh, yeah.
It's about the same, I think. Let's see. Anyway, get ready for Shady Grove now. You're going to sing it with a pine tree noter.
This is from the Warren Wilson campus, so that would be Jean's wee souvenir of today.
Little girl, stay at home, feed him when I'm gone. Shady
I've learned something. I never didn't know that a little bitty thing like that could pick like that. It's good. It's very good. I've got some turkey feathers, but I didn't have a chance to whittle one down yet. Almost every house had a dulcimer hanging on the wall or, you know, sitting on some of the furniture or hidden behind something. But so many people belonged to the new churches that were coming in, and the old regular Baptist, too, was very much against frivolous things like playing instruments. They wouldn't even sing harmony because that was frivolous. But the way they decorated the songs, sometimes it turned out to be harmony without anybody trying, and that was always pleasing to their ears. But if you saw somebody coming, one of the preachers coming over for dinner or something, you sort of put the dulcimer behind the Davenport or somewhere where they wouldn't see it. And so Maud Carpelis said when she and Cecil Sharp came collecting that when I was talking about dulcimers being around us, she said she didn't see any dulcimers. She couldn't figure out what I was talking about. And I said to her, you didn't know where to look, that's all.
And yet, in spite of that, you took your dulcimer with you to New York City in the late 40s, and you played it in Greenwich Village. You were, you worked with Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and Doc Watson at a time which seems like a dream time to us now, looking back. And your dulcimer must have seemed all a bit exotic up in New York, perhaps, because I'm sure many people wouldn't have encountered the dulcimer in that sort of environment. And you sparked an interest in the instrument, didn't you, in the
city? Nobody had ever seen a dulcimer in New York that I found. Maybe there were some people there that knew what they were, but I never found them. I would always take my dulcimer wherever I played and tell people in the crowd that came, in the few people that came, however it was, that it's a very easy thing to play. Anyone can play it. Come up after the program, and I'll show you all I know about the dulcimer in 5 minutes. And I can still say that because I don't know very much about it. I just play the way I play. And I play sort of a counter melody to the voice, and that's all I do. I ramble around on the dulcimer. I just use it as a second voice, as an accompaniment. And it was an icebreaker always. I would carry it on the subway wrapped up in a shawl because I didn't have a box for it or a case. And I'd have it all kind of tied up a little bit to keep it from coming apart. And everybody, a lot of people would say, what is that? You know, so they'd see this end of it sticking out. And I'd say, well, it's a dulcimer. It's from Kentucky. And they'd say, play it. I said, with the subway going, I mean, you couldn't hear it if I played it. They said, play it anyway. So I'd hold it up with them, and I'd go. And they'd say, oh. But you'd have to do it right in their ear, you know. Oh, they'd say, as if that was the most gorgeous sound they ever heard. And it was a completely new thing to everybody. And I would keep on saying, telling everybody, just play, play, play. And some of them did. After a while, a lot of people got to play in them. I won't claim, I never claim solo credit for getting the dulcimer around the country, but I certainly started early and urged a lot of people to play, and did my best.
Well, Jean, you've been an ambassador for the Appalachian dulcimer as well as a great steward of your family's song traditions. We're with Jean Ritchie at Warren Wilson College, home to the Swannanoa Gathering. Thanks for joining us. And stay with me as Jean lines out Amazing Grace in the style of the old regular Baptist church of her youth. You'll also hear her perform with Doc Watson. That was recorded in Greenwich Village in 1962. Look for more background to this programme online at thistleradio.com. This is NPR. Fiona and Jean Ritchie, still with you at the Swan and Noah gathering. Jean, we'll go on to talk about your first meeting with Doc Watson, but I notice on the recording of your 1962 concert together that Doc got you to sing Amazing Grace. Now, we've got some lovely singers here today, and I was wondering, would you lead us in Amazing Grace?
I'll try. This is the old regular way of singing it, and I'll just do the first verse the way I sang it at home in Mom's church, and then I will line out a couple of verses for you to join in the way they do at home. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. But now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear. Grace, my fear relieved, and grace, my fear relieved. How precious did that grace appear? How precious did that grace appear? The hour I first believed, the hour I first be, when we've been there 10,000 years, when we've been there 10,000, bright shining as the sun, bright shining as the sun. We've no less days to sing God's praise. We've no less days to sing God than when we first begun, than when we first begun. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see.
Describe the contrast for you moving from rural Kentucky, your dulcimer under one arm and a bag under the other, presumably, up to New York City in the 40s. What was that like for you?
Great, I guess you'd call it. I knew that I was going to go to the biggest city in the world, from Viper, Kentucky, which was probably the smallest community in the world.
Tell us about some of the music you encountered when you first went there.
Well, we lived there about a little while after. That's when I married. We married in 1950. We had our first child while we lived in a loft in Greenwich Village in Washington Square. A lot of people would gather on Sunday afternoon and bring their instruments and play. John Cohen was there, too, and a lot of other people. And they would all just sit around and stand around. George has some pictures of Jack Elliott playing in Washington Square. He has a picture of Mary Travers in her teens singing with somebody else, and that's been used in a lot of books and everything. She was a young teenager then. I didn't sing. We didn't sing there. I don't know why. We sang along with everybody, but I never took a dulcimer and played there because I had the baby carriage, and I had to watch the baby. So we just went over and listened to the music mostly and sang along, but I never made much of my being there. So.
And then you found your way onto WNYC Radio, mm-hmm. the Oscar Brand show, and were performing there.
Yeah, I was a regular on that show for a while, and we had a good time. George and I would be out at the beach or something on Sunday afternoon at 6 o'clock when I was supposed to be back on the Oscar Brand show. And we would drive like the wind trying to get there and get stuck in traffic and everything. And I'd go in late, and Oscar and everybody else would be playing along and looking daggers at me as I came in the door. I'd say, I got stuck in traffic. They'd say, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Same old excuse today, isn't it?
Yeah.
and although you were both from the South, you hadn't necessarily encountered the music of Doc Watson, I don't think, at that point. And you met him in New York and performed together, didn't you?
Where did we meet? The Clarence Ashley Band, right. Uh-huh. Doc was wanted me to sing a couple of songs with him because he thought that our voices would go well. And we sang Storms on the Ocean, and I helped him sing Amazing Grace and a few other things. And two or three years ago, I went to the Common Ground on the Hill, and they got Doc to come also, and the two of us got up and did that old record on stage. He had his band with him, and that was just a wonderful time. I mean, we both were so happy to meet again and to do those songs.
He's so bashful.
Oh, I'll get through laughing and start it in a minute. Where are you going, my pretty little miss? Where are you going, my daisy?
Oh, if I don't get me a young man soon, I think I'm going crazy. Hiring to my ding to my doodle doodle dum, hiring to my ding to my doody. Hiring to my ding to my doodle doodle dum, hiring to my ding to my doody.
How old are you, my pretty little miss? How old are you, my honey?
Well, if I don't die of a broken heart, I'll be 16 next summer.
Oh, can you court my pretty little miss? Oh, can you court wildflowers?
Well, I can court more in a minute and a half than you can in an hour. Hiring to my ding to my diddle little dum, hiring to my ding to my doody. Hiring to my ding to my diddle little dum, hiring to my ding to my doody.
Will you marry me, my pretty little miss? Will you marry me good looking?
Well, I'll marry you, but I won't do your washing and your cooking. Hiring to my ding to my diddle little dum, hiring to my ding to my doody. Hiring to my ding to my diddle little dum, hiring to my ding to my doody.
Then I won't marry you, my pretty little miss. I won't marry you, my dear old.
Oh, who's asking you to marry me, you big black-headed scarecrow? Hiring to my ding to my diddle little dum, hiring to my ding to my doody. Hiring to my ding to my diddle little dum, hiring to my ding to my doody.
I'm sure back in those days when you were in New York City and people realised what you had in the way of songs and stories and a slice of American history and life to share, that they wanted to come to you and learn songs from you, and they saw you as probably a great source.
Well, some of that, yeah, I got quite a bit of that. But I have one just now that has applied for a grant to come and study with me for a year. But that happens through the years. Not a great lot of people, but here and there it has happened.
So you've been a source of songs for people. The Ritchie family has had a repertoire of songs that many people have turned to. But you also became a song hunter, going to find sources of songs, and you got a Fulbright scholarship, didn't you? You travelled with your family, your two young sons and your husband to England and Scotland in search of songs. What did you find when you got there? Was that in the 1950s?
It was 1952 and 53, yeah. I had applied for a grant to go to England, Scotland, and Ireland and look for the sources of my family songs, because we had quite a few ballads and old songs that referred to the old countries and so on. So there was a lot of people. I mean, the people on the board were having their meeting, and I was late in taking my record up to have them hear it. We stopped in one of these places that made records on the
yes.
street, with it, and they made an actual vinyl record, and you could see all the stuff flying off the record and the needle going around and everything making the record. And I grabbed that in my hand and ran up there, George and I did, and they were all in the meeting room, and she said, I better check this record first. Sometimes those things don't work so well. And she played something like Lovin' Hannah, and I was going, I rode to church last Sunday, my true love passed me by. And I said, this is awful. And I started to almost cry. And then she said, why don't you just go in there and sing for them? They all started talking about the songs. I was singing a lot. I sang about six. They kept me going for about six songs, you know. So I knew I was going to get it then. And that's how I got my scholarship.
You don't still have that record lying around in the house, do you?
I don't. I think I went home and broke it up.
It's Raining Picks, by the way. We've got a couple more handed up here
mercy.
Any that you might want to try out.
Let's see. People are very inventive,
mm-hmm.
aren't they?
Yep. Yeah. So what did you find when you got over to England, Scotland, and Ireland back then, and you started looking for songs and making connections with ballad singers? And
I found a lot of wonderful people. When you collect songs, you collect more than songs. You collect friends, people, you collect places, you collect memories of every time I sing certain songs, I think of the place it was where I learned it. Not every time, maybe, but one thing strikes me is when I was a tiny child, we went out on the school ground, and there was a new girl that had just come into school. She was a little tiny thing, and she had blonde hair that came way down, and she was very pale, and it turned out that her name was Blanche White. I didn't know what Blanche meant then, so the name didn't mean anything. Later on, I got a joke out of it. But she wanted to sing a song for us, and her father was working on the railroad. He was one of the switchmen or something. He didn't stay in the neighborhood long, but he stayed a few months, and we all got to like Blanche White. She sang this song for me, for a bunch of us. We're all huddled around like you do on the school ground when you're listening to something. Oh, where are you going, little bird, little bird? Oh, where are you going, little birdie? I'm going to the woods, I'm going to the woods, I'm going to the woods, sweet child. Oh, what's in the woods, little bird, little bird? Oh, what's in the woods, little birdie? There's a tree in the wood, there's a tree in the wood, there's a tree in the woods, sweet child. Oh, what's in the tree, little bird, little bird? Oh, what's in the tree, little birdie? There's a sweet little nest, there's a sweet little nest, a sweet little nest, sweet child. Oh, what's in the nest, little bird, little bird? Oh, what's in the nest, little birdie? There are three little birds, there are three little birds, three little birds, sweet child. Oh, what can they say, little bird, little bird? Oh, what can they say, little birdie? They can say, praise the Lord. They can say, praise the Lord. They can say, praise the Lord, sweet child. And we always sung another verse. Oh, what do they say, little bird, little bird? Did they say, little birdie? They would say, peep, peep. They would say, peep, peep. they would say, "Peep, peep, sweet child." And we added that verse on right then when she sang it. She'd never sung that before. But we started dancing around then and sing. They would say, "Peep, peep," and throwing our arms up, and we had the best time. And I remember that. Every time I hear anything like that song, I remember that few minutes on the school ground at recess when we learned that song. And so you collect memories like that, and you collect, as I say, a sense of place where the song comes from. And it's just wonderful.
And I will all remember Blanche White. So in your travels, Jean, did it answer any questions for you about where your songs are from and where your family heritage came from? Were there any specific questions it answered, or did it just give you that greater understanding and sense of connection?
I used a song that we have in our family to sort of see if, because it's a well-known song throughout the world, parts of the world, that's Barbara Ellen. So I used Barbara Ellen as a collecting technique, and I would say, "Do you know Barbara Ellen?" And most everybody would. So I've got many, many verses of Barbara Ellen all throughout the countries, one from Bess Cronin and one from Jeannie Robertson. All over the islands, people knew that song. The way I would do it, I would sit down with my dulcimer and play Barbara Ellen for them, and they would immediately, they couldn't wait till I got through in order to sing theirs for me, you know. So then we'd go on to other songs that would break the ice, and we'd go on to other songs, and they'd sing whatever they thought was popular in their family or whatever they especially loved. They'd pass it on to us, and we would sing for them, and they would sing for us, and that was the good way, because you give something and you get something.
Mm-hmm. Were they aware, were they surprised when this American lady sat down and sang a song that they recognized or that was very close to a song that they'd sung? Had they realized where their songs had gone to?
Many of them had seen collectors before, though, like Seamus Innes and Peter Kennedy had been the year before us. No, the 2 years before us. Alan Lomax had been the year before us with some of them, not all of them. Hamish. Well, Hamish took us all around Scotland. Yeah, he was. He would say, "See you on pub." There's a lot of good singing in there. So we'd all fall for it every time we'd go into the pub. There'd be nobody there singing. And Hamish said, "Oh, well, as long as we're here, let's have a..." but we had a wonderful time, and we met great people and had a lot of good time singing, a lot of good parties in Cayley's, and a wonderful one in the Macomb Cottage in County Armagh, where we met a young man, the young boy of the house, Sarah Macomb's youngest son, Tommy Macomb, and he didn't know any songs. He knew one song. He played the tin whistle, and he knew one song, Nell Flaherty's Drake, and he sang that for us. Then after we left, his mother told me later that he went all around town, knocked on all the doors, and said to the lady, when she came to the door, he said, "Sing me all your old songs." And they did, and he learned a lot of songs and became a folk singer, a singer of traditional songs. We patted ourselves a little on the back for that, because we had inspired in him the fact that people cherished these songs, and they were something besides, it's just as I learned it when I was little, that they were something besides our own enjoyment. They were that the rest of the world was interested also, and he got busy.
Why do you think some of these old songs that came over with your with those six Ritchie brothers in the 1700s and that have been old even then, why are we still singing them, and why are they still important to us today?
People ask that a lot. They say, why do you keep on singing these old songs? There's so much new stuff now you could be learning. And I was raised on the songs, and partly it's the memories they bring back, and partly it's that they're good songs. They wouldn't have lasted all these years if they hadn't been good, you know. And they also have advice, and they have things happen in the songs that you still happen today. unfortunately, sometimes. Many murder ballads are we shouldn't emulate, but still it does happen. And you get people's feelings about it. You get sometimes to know what to do about it. And they're not only still beautiful, but they're still meaningful. And that's, I think, the reason they last so long. Not making much sense, am I?
I think you are. I think you're making a lot of sense. And I did want to share some of Jean's words from her book that I think maybe bookend nicely what you just said, Jean. The lovely past was not gone. It had just been shut up inside of a song, inside of 100 songs. I knew that no matter how far apart we might scatter the world over, that we'd still be the Ritchie family as long as we lived and sing the same old songs, and that the songs would live as long as there was a family. Let's give her the sort of applause that will carry her homeward, northward, in the not-too-distant future. Thank you so much, Jean Ritchie.
Thanks to Fiona.
Thanks also to sound engineer Al Petaway, George and John Pico, Julie Glaub, Jim and Beth McGill, Doug and Darcy Orr, and Margaret Kennedy. The Thistle and Shamrock is a thistleradio.com production. See and hear more from our visit with Jean Ritchie at our website, along with programme playlists updated and archived each week at thistleradio.com. This album won a Rolling Stone Critics Award in 1977. This is Jean Ritchie, None But One.
Across the plain there moves a sway. It moves with human sound. And some do walk and some do run. Some crawl upon the ground. And some do stop to help the weak. Some trample on the others. And some do laugh and some do weep. And all of them were brothers. And sound and all around the sound, around and everywhere. And none but one can understand, and none but one can hear. I'm mine and I thine, father, mother, son. I'm me and I be, and all of us are one. I saw four travelers in a dream, all in the wind and weather. The chain they carried in their hands bound them all together. And one was yellow, one was red, and older than the others. And one was black and one was white, and all of them were brothers. And sounding all around the sound, round and everywhere. And none but one can understand, and none but one can hear. Thank you.
remembering our friend Jean Ritchie this week on the Thistle and Shamrock in our programme first broadcast in 2008. Streaming music round the clock at thistleradio.com, the Thistle and Shamrock is a service mark of Fiona Ritchie. Support for NPR comes from Jane and Michael Horvitz, supporting NPR and 90.3 WCPN Idea Stream in Cleveland, dedicated to building a more informed community together by producing in-depth journalism that informs, engages and inspires. 90.3 Idea Stream. The Roth Family Foundation, investing in organisations that inspire hope, dignity and creativity, working to connect communities to the services, opportunities and tools for self-empowerment and self-expression. Learn more at rothfamilyfoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people from diverse backgrounds and ensure that they reach their fullest potential. More information is available at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR Music.